Welcome back to another episode of the Lord of the Rings AMA podcast. My name is Matthias Austin, and on this podcast, I invite you to ask me anything about Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, or anything related to the greater legendarium of J.R.R. Tolkien, and I will do my best to give you as in-depth an answer as I can. And I want to start by just thanking everyone who has sent in questions recently. I went from genuinely worrying I would run out to now I've got several months' worth lined up ready to go. So if you sent something in and you haven't heard your episode yet, don't worry, it is coming. But also, keep sending them in. It's been really fun for me to see all of the places people are listening from, and it really speaks to the impact of Tolkien's work and the impact that work has had on really the entire world. And if you do want to submit a question, you can email it to lotramapod@gmail.com, just like this week's question asker, Anna, I think Anna, not Anna, but could be Anna, from Washington State. Anna asks, in The Return of the King, Elrond tells Aragorn about the men who dwell in the mountains. We briefly see them in the movie. What is their backstory? Why were they cursed? Well, thank you, Anna, for that question. And as we approach Halloween, this question feels appropriate as we talk about the army of the dead and the king of the dead, this ghost army that, in the movies, annihilates the orcs at Pelennor Fields, swarming over Oliphants and saving the day for our heroes. And that does go a little bit differently in the books, but I'll get into the differences between the book army and the movie army later. But before we get into what they did in death, let's talk about who these people were in life. Because of the state of the world of Middle-earth at the end of the Third Age, it can often seem like Middle-earth is just largely empty, and the only humans are the men of Rohan and Gondor, and that weird little pocket of people living up in Bree. But this is not really the case, as we hear about Beornings, east of the River Anduin. Beor was the bear person in The Hobbit, if you've read The Hobbit. And obviously they've got the people of Dale, out by Long Lake in The Hobbit, who had this thriving trade of like wine with the people of Rovanion, which is out further east. And of course, Saruman, he makes an alliance with the Dunlendings, these native people of Rohan, whose land was granted to the Rohirrim when they arrived in the area to aid Gondor. And we get little glimpses of the Dunlendings in the movies. It's the group that, you know, Saruman sends out to destroy villages, and we see one guy make a blood oath, you know, whom do you serve? Saruman! You know, that scene. And in a previous episode, I talked about the Druidane that assisted Theoden's army on their journey south to Minas Tirith. Well, the men that made up the Army of the Dead were much like the Dunlendings and other quote-unquote native peoples. They were also called the Men of the Mountains, and they lived in and around the White Mountains that made up part of the border between Gondor and Rohan. And they had lived there for many thousands of years. In The History of Middle-earth, Volume 12, The Peoples of Middle-earth, Tolkien says that these people, both the Men of the Mountains and the Dunlendings, were distantly related to one of the three houses of men who fought alongside the elves of Beleriand in the First Age, the people of Haleth, or the Haladin. But unlike the Haladin, the men that stayed east of Beleriand were often evil, cruel, and by the Second Age of Middle-earth, they were already under the sway of Sauron. And they maybe were led to this by refugees of evil men who fought for Morgoth in the First Age. Evidence for this can be found in the Silmarillion, in the section called the Akalabeth, about the downfall of Numenor. And in there, Tolkien writes, in the great battle, when at last Morgoth was overthrown and Thangorodrim was broken, the Edain, or Edain, which are the three houses of men that served, that helped fight Morgoth, the Edain alone of the kindreds of men fought for the Valar, whereas many others fought for Morgoth. And after the victory of the Lords of the West, those of the evil men who were not destroyed fled back into the East, where many of their race were still wandering in unharvested lands, wild and lawless, refusing alike the summons of the Valar and of Morgoth. And the evil men came among them and cast over them a shadow of fear, and they took them for kings. Then the Valar forsook for a time the men of Middle-earth who refused their summons and had taken the friends of Morgoth to be their masters. And men dwelt in darkness and were troubled by many evil things that Morgoth had devised in the days of his dominion. Demons and dragons and misshapen beasts and the unclean orcs that were mockeries of the children of Iluvatar. And the lot of men was unhappy. Those houses of the Edain were given Numenor as a gift, so they left Middle-earth for a long time, and the elves at first all lived in the far northwest near the Blue Mountains, which left Sauron largely unimpeded in the south and east of Middle-earth. But while he grew in power, so did the Numenoreans, and they eventually began to turn away from the Valar and wanted to increase their own power. And they began to make colonies along the coasts of Middle-earth, which Sauron greatly resented, and he attempted to wage war on the Numenoreans. But the power of the Numenoreans was so great that even Sauron realized that he was outmatched, and so he surrendered himself and he went to Numenor as a prisoner. Now this would directly lead to the fall of Numenor, which I'm not going to get into now, but for the purposes of this episode, the relevant details are: after the destruction of Numenor, Sauron's spirit fled back to Mordor, where he began gearing up for war again. Meanwhile, Isildur and Anarion, sons of Elendil, landed in Gondor and began to build their kingdom, while Elendil did the same in the north with the kingdom of Arnor. And the land of the Men of the Mountains suddenly had new rulers after millennia of worshipping and obeying Sauron. And Isildur and Anarion had brought with them from Numenor a big stone, like a spherical, like a globe, about 7 feet tall, and they placed it in a valley called Irik, and it was named the Stone of Irik. Not all of the names in Tolkien's work have to be super clever, okay? It was the Stone of Irik because that's where the valley was that it was in. And as for what Irik means, well, it's unknown. It seems that it was the original name given to that valley by the Men of the Mountains, but Tolkien wrote in a 1967 letter that he had come across the name in his study of ancient Mesopotamian history as the name of like a ruined city, and he thought it just kind of fit the vibe of his world, so he just borrowed it. Anyway, at the Stone of Irik, Isildur called the King of the Mountain Folk to swear allegiance to him in the event they ever went to war with Sauron. And they swore that oath over that stone. Aragorn explains to Gimli and Legolas what happened in The Return of the King. This is what Aragorn says. "For at Irik there stands yet a black stone that was brought, it is said, from Numenor by Isildur. And it was set upon a hill, and upon it the King of the Mountains swore allegiance to him in the beginning of the realm of Gondor. But when Sauron returned and grew in might again, Isildur summoned the Men of the Mountains to fulfill their oath, and they would not, for they had worshipped Sauron in the dark years. Then Isildur said to their king, 'Thou shalt be the last king, and if the West prove mightier than thy black master, this curse I lay upon thee and thy folk, to rest never until your oath is fulfilled. For this war will last through years uncounted, and you shall be summoned once again ere the end.' And they fled before the wrath of Isildur, and did not dare to go forth to war on Sauron's part, and they hid themselves in secret places in the mountains, and had no dealings with other men, but slowly dwindled in the barren hills. And the terror of the sleepless dead lies about the hill of Irik, and all places where that people lingered." So yeah, basically they were cursed to live as ghosts because they refused to fight against Sauron in the War of the Last Alliance. Now this raises all sorts of questions about how magic really works in Middle-earth, because while being a Numenorean descended from powerful men and elves, Isildur was, at his core, just a guy. So why did he have the ability to curse spirits to not pass on to the afterlife? Well, this is one of those moments that I said I would periodically update you all on. Those moments where the direct intervention of Iluvatar could be seen. Because only Iluvatar, not even the Valar could do this, only Iluvatar has the power to alter the natural cycle of life and death, as was the case of Beren and Lúthien. And so it may be that Isildur laying down this curse was actually like an appeal to Ilúvatar, and because Ilúvatar is omniscient and we would have known that Aragorn would one day need their help, he granted Isildur's wish. Or maybe he put the thought into Isildur's mind. Who knows the wills and the whims of Ilúvatar? But however it happened, the end result is that when the Men of the Mountains died, their spirits remained, haunting the valleys through the mountains where they once lived, and turning them into the Paths of the Dead, a trail that filled any who walked through them with dread and fear. And the path led through the winding valleys of the White Mountains until it led to the Dark Door, which led inside the mountains. And until Aragorn and his followers, and more on who made up those followers later, no one had ever passed through that doorway, except for one person, a prince of Rohan. Théoden tells the story to Merry after they arrive at the camp at Dunharrow, and find Aragorn and their crew have already left for the Paths of the Dead. Théoden says this: "It is said that when the Eorlingus came out of the north and passed at length up the Snowborn, seeking strong places of refuge in time of need, Brego and his son Baldur climbed the stair of the hold and so came before the door. On the threshold sat an old man, aged beyond guess of years. Tall and kingly he had been, but now he was withered as an old stone. Indeed, for stone they took him, for he moved not, and he said no word, until they sought to pass by him and enter. Then a voice came out of him, as if it were of the ground, and to their amaze it spoke in the western tongue.
'The way is shut.'
Then they halted and looked at him, and saw that he lived still. But he did not look at them.
'The way is shut,'
his voice said again.
'It was made by those who are dead, and the dead keep it until the time comes. The way is shut.'"
"And when will that time be?" said Baldur. But no answer did he ever get. For the old man died in that hour, and fell upon his face, and no other tidings of the ancient dwellers in the mountains have our folk ever learned. So that's how Théoden explains it to Merry. And some Tolkien scholars believe that this was the last living Man of the Mountain. He was certainly not a ghost, because he died. Ghosts can't die. So they saw him die, so they knew he wasn't a ghost, and nobody else lived in the mountains, so they thought maybe this is the last Man of the Mountains. And Tolkien then expands on what happened next to Baldur in Appendix A of The Return of the King, where he gives a timeline of the House of Eorl, which are the kings of Rohan. So the timeline goes like this. Brego, the second king of Rohan, he drove the enemy out of the Wold, and Rohan was not attacked for many years. In 2569, he completed the Great Hall of Meduseld. At the feast, his son Baldur vowed that he would tread the paths of the dead, and did not return. Brego died of grief the next year. And Aragorn actually found his body during his passage under the mountains. In the chapter, The Passing of the Grey Company, this is what we hear. "Before him were the bones of a mighty man. He had been clad in mail, and still his harness lay there whole, for the caravan's air was as dry as dust, and his hauberk was gilded. His belt was of gold and garnets, and rich with gold was the helm upon his bony head, face downward on the floor. He had fallen near the wall of the cave, as now could be seen, and before him stood a stony door closed fast. His finger bones were still clawing at the cracks. A notched and broken sword lay by him, as if he had hewn at the rock in his last despair. Aragorn did not touch him, but after gazing silently for a while, he rose and sighed, 'Hither shall the flowers of Cymbelmain come never unto world's end,' he murmured. 9 mounds and 7 there are now, green with grass, and through all the long years he has lain at that door that he could not unlock. Whither does it lead? Why would he pass? None shall ever know. For that is not my errand,' he cried, turning back and speaking to the whispering darkness behind. 'Keep your hoards and your secrets hidden in the accursed years. Speed only we ask. Let us pass, and then come. I summon you to the Stone of Eric.'" This is maybe the mystery that bothers me the most of anything Tolkien wrote. Tom Bombadil, all right then, keep your secrets. How does magic really work? What happened to the blue wizard? What's beyond the edges of the map? None of those questions plague me as much as what was through that door, and how exactly did Baldur die? Was he running from something or someone? Was he physically attacked? Or did the fear of the dead, like, give him a heart attack or something? Like Aragorn said, we can only just say, none shall ever know. But the old man who gave Brego and Baldur I guess you could call it a prophecy, or a warning with foresight or something, he was not the only one to speak about the paths of the dead. About 600 years before Baldur, in the northern kingdom of Arnor, there was a man named Malbeth the Seer, and he was a prophet. And we know of two prophecies that he gave in his lifetime. The first we talked about in our previous episode about Aragorn, about how Arvedui would be the last king of Arnor. But the second prophecy was this. Over the land there lies a long shadow, westward reaching wings of darkness. The tower trembles, to the tombs of kings doom approaches. The dead awaken, for the hour is come for the oathbreakers. At the stone of Eric they shall stand again, and hear there a horn in the hills ringing. Whose shall the horn be? Who shall call them from the grey twilight, the forgotten people? The heir of him to whom the oath they swore. From the north he shall come, need shall drive him, he shall pass the door of the paths of the dead. Now, I don't know how much that would have even meant to the people of Arvedui's time, a time where the tower, presumably the Tower of Barad-dûr, it was in ruins, and they were hundreds of miles away in the north. But still, that prophecy, it was remembered, and Aragorn even knew it by heart. All right, I'm now going to go start doing like a little bit of a side-by-side comparison between the books and the movies, because the story goes a little bit differently depending on the version. In the movies, Aragorn is at the camp of Dunharrow, and a mysterious figure arrives. And it turns out to be Elrond with the reforged shards of Narsil, now called Anduril, Flame of the West. And Elrond urges Aragorn to take the paths of the dead. But in the books, Aragorn already has his sword. It was reforged before they left Rivendell, and Elrond isn't the one who arrives. Instead, it is a company of rangers from the north, Dunedain, Aragorn's kinsmen, who have traveled the long miles to find him. There are about 30 of them. And with them is not Elrond, but his twin sons, the brothers of Arwen, Eladan and Elrohir. And they bring with them two things. A banner made by Arwen with the flag of Isildur, and these words of warning from Elrond. Bid Aragorn remember the words of the seer and the paths of the dead. So it isn't just the trio of Aragorn, Gimli, and Legolas taking the paths of the dead. It's also about 30 rangers of the north and two more elven princes. In the books, we're given the perspective of the characters, particularly Gimli, and his sense of growing dread and fear. But the internal feelings of a character, it's really hard to portray on screen, so Peter Jackson tried to, like, up the horror. We see the heroes walking on paths of skulls, surrounded by green wisps, and we see this dramatic confrontation between Aragorn and the King of the Dead. And at least in the extended versions, and it's been a very long time since I've seen the theatrical editions, the King of the Dead tries to attack Aragorn, but the sword is blocked by Anduril, showing that Aragorn is the rightful king. And then there's like an avalanche of skulls before our heroes make their way out, and the army of the dead emerges to help fight. But the whole process takes a bit longer in the books. They're traveling through the paths of the dead well into the night before they arrive at the Stone of Eric. And along the way, they're joined and followed by this ghostly army. They emerge from the mountains and they have to ride through this densely populated area where the fear of the dead causes the people to retreat into their homes and ring warning bells, which is actually kind of nice to see because it does show Middle-earth isn't as empty as the movies sometimes make it seem. But they finally arrive at the Stone of Eric, and here's how the book describes that scene. Bells were ringing far below, and all men fled before the face of Aragorn. But the Grey Company in their haste rode like hunters, until their horses were stumbling with weariness. And thus, just ere midnight, and in a darkness as black as the caverns in the mountains, they came at last to the Hill of Eric, To that stone, the company came and halted in the dead of night. Then Elrohir gave to Aragorn a silver horn, and he blew upon it, and it seemed to those that stood near that they had heard the sound of answering horns, as if it was an echo in deep caves far away. No other sound they heard, and yet they were aware of a great host gathered all about the hill on which they stood, and a chill wind like the breath of ghosts came down from the mountains. But Aragorn dismounted, and standing by the stone, he cried in a great voice, "Oathbreakers, why have ye come?" And a voice was heard out of the night that answered him, as if from far away,
"To fulfill our oath and have peace."
Then Aragorn said, "The hour is come at last. Now I go to Pelagrir upon Anduin, and ye shall come after me. And when all this land is clean of the servants of Sauron, I will hold the oath fulfilled, and ye shall have peace and depart forever. For I am Elessar, Isildur's heir of Gondor." And with that he bade Halbarad, which is one of the Dúnedain, he bade Halbarad unfurl the great standard which he had brought. And behold, it was black, and if there was any device upon it, it was hidden in the darkness. Then there was silence, and not a whisper nor a sigh was heard again for all the long night. The company camped beside the stone, but they slept little, because of the dread of the shadows that hedged them round. But when the dawn came, cold and pale, Aragorn rose at once, and he led the company forth upon the journey of greatest haste and weariness that any among them had known, save he alone, and only his will held them to go on. No other mortal man could have endured it, none but the Dúnedain of the North, and with them Gimli the Dwarf and Legolas of the Elves. The next day there came no dawn, and the Grey Company passed on into the darkness of the Storm of Mordor and were lost to mortal sight, but the dead followed them. And it's not till much later we find out about what happened, and it's very different from the movies. In the movies, the dead, they kill the Corsairs of Umbar that are bringing a fleet up the river. Then Aragorn, he takes a boat, does this big dramatic leap onto the docks outside of Minas Tirith, and the army of the dead sweep the field, saving the day. And Aragorn says he holds their oath fulfilled, and they fade away. But in the books, that's not even close to what happens. There was this whole second army of Gondor that was set up in this defensive position, awaiting the arrival of the Corsairs. And Aragorn knew that without that army in the Battle of the Pelennor Fields, they were going to lose. And Gimli and Legolas, they recount to Merry and Pippin after the battle what happened when the Grey Company reached that army and the fleet of the Corsairs. See, first they found a small army protecting, like, some fords, and the dead scared everybody away, so that army was able to join with them as they continued until they reached the city of Pelagrir. Gimli tells them, I'm not going to do the Scottish accent. "We came upon them at last upon battle in earnest. There at Pelagrir lay the main fleet of Umbar, 50 great ships and smaller vessels beyond count. Many of those that we pursued had reached the havens before us, and brought their fear with them, and some of the ships had put off, seeking to escape down the river or to reach the far shore, and many of the smaller craft were ablaze. But the Haradrim, being now driven to the brink, turned at bay, and they were fierce in despair, and they laughed when they looked on us, for they were a great army still. But Aragorn halted and cried with a great voice, Now come, by the Black Stone I call you! And suddenly the shadow host that had hung back at the last came up like a grey tide, sweeping all before it. Faint cries I heard, and dim horns blowing, and a murmur as of countless far voices. It was the echo of some forgotten battle in the dark years long ago. Pale swords were drawn, but I know not whether their blades would still bite, for the dead needed no longer any weapon but fear. None would withstand them. To every ship they came that was drawn up, and then they passed over the waters to those that were anchored, and all the mariners were filled with a madness of terror, and leaped overboard, save the slaves chained to the oars. Reckless we rode among our fleeing foes, driving them like leaves, until we came to the shore." Yeah, so basically, the ghosts just made the guys on the ships afraid, so they jumped in the water, and the troops of Aragorn... And the troops that Aragorn collected were able to rout them. And Gimli ends the story like this. "Mighty indeed was Aragorn that day. Lo, all the black fleet was in his hands, and he chose the greatest ship to be his own, and he went up into it. Then he let sound a great concourse of trumpets taken from the enemy, and the shadow host withdrew to the shore. There they stood silent, hardly to be seen, save for a red gleam in their eyes that caught the glare of the ships that were burning. And Aragorn spoke in a loud voice to the dead men, crying, "Hear now the words of the heir of Isildur. Your oath is fulfilled. Go back and trouble not the valleys ever again. Depart and be at rest." And thereupon the king of the dead stood out before the host and broke his spear and cast it down. Then he bowed low and turned away, and swiftly the whole gray host drew off and vanished like a mist that is driven back by a sudden wind. And then they just load all the troops from the now empty ships, and they sail them up the river to Minas Tirith, where they arrive just in time to turn the tide of the battle and win. Now, I do understand why Peter Jackson made the choice to cut the Grey Company and that second army and just stick with CGI ghosts. It would be adding more named characters along with tons more extras to an already long movie. But the choice to make the army of ghosts turn into this invincible combat force sort of cheapens the outcome of the battle. Whereas having them just sow fear and panic is like an element to the victory, not the whole victory. So it's not like a deus ex machina or deus ex ghost. So there you go, Anna. I hope that answers all of your questions about the Men of the Mountains, why they were cursed, and some bonus stuff about the differences between the books and the movies. But before we end today, I want to add a segment to this show, something that won't happen every week, but only when it's relevant. And that is... This Week in Middle-Earth. This episode is being released on October 27, and two very important things happened on the journey of Frodo right around this time of year. On October 24th of the year 3018 of the Third Age of Middle-Earth, at about 10 o'clock in the morning, according to Gandalf, Frodo awoke in Rivendell, having been healed by Elrond the previous day. And the next day, on October 25th, the Council of Elrond meets to decide the fate of the Ring. And like I said, that segment is only going to recur when big events are happening. And as the Fellowship won't leave Rivendell for 2 months after this, it'll be a while before it comes back, so we'll see if I even remember that I did this. And if you've got any questions for other segments that you want to see on the show, email in. You can email me at lotramapod@gmail.com, which is also where you can send me in any questions you have. Follow me on all the socials at lotramapod on Instagram and Threads and Blue Sky and YouTube. Links for all of that is in the show notes. Subscribe to the show so you don't miss anything. Please feel free to leave a 5-star rating and review, tell your friends, all of that good stuff. Thank you as always to Michael for our music and Lauren for our artwork. And that is all for this week. Iluvatar willing, I'll be back next week. See you then.